Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Private space flight was all but unimaginable just a few decades ago. Now we have companies like SpaceX, Blue Origin, and Virgin Galactic in our news. My guest today is Julian Guthrie, an award-winning journalist, also a long time at the San Francisco Chronicle, author of several books, including The Billionaire and the Mechanic. That one was about Oracle CEO Larry Ellison's quest for the America's Cup. Her latest book is How to Make a Spaceship, A Band of Renegades, An Epic Race, and the Birth of Private Spaceflight. It's the story of the worldwide contest for the $10 million XPRIZE to build a private reusable spaceship. Julian Guthrie joins us by phone for the entire hour. Julian, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm happy to be on. I hear you're one of these space, I don't know.
Geek?
Geek? Is that the okay word?
Sure. Oh, yeah, especially during this hour, that is used only in the most flattering way.
It is. I use it that way, in a flattering way.
Yes, actually, reading this book, I had a lot in common, especially my Estes rocket period growing up here in Iowa.
Oh, that's fantastic. Right. Kids don't try this at home, hoarding explosives in your closet to create your own rockets and motors.
Yes, I've never divulged this before.
Starting out with Estes.
Right. I've never divulged this before, but I did shoot up things that actually blew up intentionally. But let's stop right there with mine. Story, because this
is come on. Let's focus on your youthful escapades.
That's a different program, Julian. We'll call you for that one. I want to reach out to our listeners, perhaps other aerospace geeks who want to get in on this conversation with Julian Guthrie this hour. Your questions about private space flight, 1-866-780-9100. Email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Julian, in your book, you first tell us about the background of the several people involved in the XPRIZE, namely Peter Diamandis. He's a Greek-American engineer, a physician, an entrepreneur, founder and chairman of the XPRIZE Foundation. He is the driving force here. But also Bert Rutan. He's the inventor of the spaceship that did it, Spaceship One. Bert's brother, Dick. Also the two test pilots, Mike Melville and Brian Binney. Let's start, as you do in the book, to talk about some of these personalities, namely Peter Diamandis. He had this youthful dream that, unlike mine, I guess, never stopped. He carried through after being inspired by the Apollo mission, right?
I know. Isn't it amazing? I mean, I had never met anyone as passionate about space as Peter Diamandis. So, and when the book opens, he's 8 years old and it's July 1969, and he's this little boy in his pajamas who gets to stay up late to watch this moment in history when Apollo 11 lands on the moon, and he is transfixed. And, his superheroes were the astronauts of the day, and the magic was created really by NASA. And so he sets out on this great quest and a very arduous one, to try to get to space. And he goes to MIT and he goes to Harvard Medical School, never intending at Harvard, which I found really kind of nuts, never intending to use his medical degree to practice medicine, but with the hopes that he would do a couple of things, advance his chances of getting into the astronaut corps and also maybe help him with what he learned, through what he learned, to live longer so he could one day get to space. Of course, he also wanted to please his Greek immigrant parents who had expected him to become a doctor like the father had in America. But he does all of these things, and he found these student space clubs and an international space university and a rocket company while he's in medical school. Mm-hmm. And so clearly he had it bad, I mean, I don't know how yours stands up by degree, but he was like,
not anywhere close.
This was an obsession. No, I don't think many people. So when he gets out of college, with the six-pack of very impressive degrees, he looks around and the space shuttle was flying, but it was over budget. And to many space aficionados and dreamers, you know, it was under delivering. It certainly was not going to take private citizens to space anytime soon or ever. Mm-hmm. And so that's when the next part of this, you know, story really begins, when that, with that realization he wasn't going to get there through NASA.
Right. And tell us here, because it's really interesting historically, the great grandson of Charles Lindbergh figures into the story. Eric Lindbergh inspires Peter to come up with this XPRIZE. Tell us a little bit about that story.
Yeah, the Lindbergh connection is really beautiful, and it was one of my favorite parts of the book. So Peter, after getting out of college, he was at his parents' home, and he was reading The Spirit of St. Louis by Charles Lindbergh. And, of course, he knew about Lindbergh's flight, but he was reading this, and this is when he had this great aha moment where he reads that, learns that Charles Lindbergh, the young airmail pilot, that he flew from New York to Paris, not as a stunt, as Peter had thought, but to try to win a $25,000 prize that had been offered by this French hotelier named Raymond Ortega. And so Lindbergh, the young airmail pilot, young pilot, lands in Paris, arguably becomes the most famous man on Earth, but more importantly, he really jumpstarts the commercial airline industry. So Peter is thinking, oh my God, what if, you know, he's writing in the margins of the book, and like, this is it, and what if I could launch an incentive competition, a prize, to jumpstart the commercial space industry, which was non-existent, in the same way the Ortega Prize through Lindbergh had done for commercial aviation. So that was a big turning point. And then, as you referenced Eric Lindbergh, so Peter tried to connect with any Lindberghs, and the Lindberghs live with this great legacy and this difficult legacy all at once. Charles Lindbergh was a very complicated individual, and the legacy was just so huge and overwhelming, which I learned. And I think this story, you know, for anybody who's an aviation buff, it's very interesting to learn about that legacy as it continues through the Lindbergh descendants, particularly Eric. Eric is a great, his narrative, his journey here is really profound. So Peter eventually tracks Eric Lindbergh down. And Eric, though, had been hobbled, literally crippled by rheumatoid arthritis. Very young, he had always been athletic. And that's when you see Peter and Eric first meeting. And Eric is dubious. Eric is like, why do we have so many problems here on Earth? Why do we need to get off planet? And why don't we use that $10 million and apply it to the problems on Earth? And he realized, you know, he listened to Peter and to this astronaut who was with Peter, a fellow named Byron Lichtenberg. He listened to them talk about, you know, how this fragile blue planet, blue marble that we are on, that it is so fragile, and that the whole system of the universe that we are in is reliant on us taking care of this planet. And the astronauts, you know, talked about how this transformative moment when they're up above Earth out of the atmosphere and they look down at this beautiful blue marble, and how that does transform people's thinking about planet Earth itself. So Eric goes on to be a key figure in this, and he's kind of rescued by the XPRIZE, and then beautifully, you know, rescues the XPRIZE when it needs it most in very dark days. So he plays a great role.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit more about the XPRIZE and how Peter came up with this, because it's not based on one flight. There are two flights, the second one to prove that the spaceship could be turned around and reused. How did that formulation, that requirement, come up?
So the XPRIZE, when he announced it in St. Louis in May 1996, and again, he's got, you know, the superheroes of his youth. He's got Buzz Aldrin up there with him, and he's got Burt Rutan, who plays a big role, and Eric Lindbergh is there, and Eric's brother Morgan Lindbergh in St. Louis. They announced the $10 million prize, and this is, it's, you know, the key was, the goal was, this was going to be given to the first team that could build and fly a manned rocket to the start of space twice within 2 weeks to prove some form of reusability. But this had to be done without the government's help. So you couldn't have government funding, you couldn't have governmental support or partnerships of any kind. And the rule was they picked not orbital flight, but kind of the suborbital trajectory where they would go out of the Earth's atmosphere. They would reach 62 miles up, which is 100 kilometers, and it's called the von Karman line, and it's the internationally accepted definition for the start of space.
Mm-hmm.
So Peter saw that as something that had never been done before by private industry. So could it be done? That was the question. And then he saw it also as obviously much, much less challenging than orbital flight, but as a stepping stone to get there. And then the fly twice within 2 weeks with a certain ballast, a certain amount of weight to simulate two pilots, or a pilot and a passenger, sorry. Those things had to all be done. And then the pilot had to stay alive for 72 hours, I think it was, after the second flight.
I guess, yeah.
Minor detail.
Yeah, you have that in the footnote. Oh, by the way, the pilot's
pilot left, has to survive.
Has to survive 72 hours after coming back to Earth. So this is really remarkable. I want to remind our listeners who perhaps just joined us, Julian Guthrie is my guest. Her latest book, How to Make a Spaceship, A Band of Renegades, An Epic Race, and the Birth of Private Spaceflight, tells the story of this contest that ended in 2004, a $10 million XPRIZE to build a private reusable spacecraft. So this is something truly remarkable, requiring small teams to do what only the world's largest governments had done before, namely to send a spaceship into space, as they defined, 62 miles, Julian just said there, and then come back and then do it again within 2 weeks. Let's talk about Burt Rutan. Well, let's. Mm-hmm. How many players, when they announced this in '96, how many players were there potentially interested? How many showed interest before we get on to the winning team?
Well, there were a couple dozen teams that registered, but in my mind, there were only at most half that who were actually viable. I think that the teams were all viable. They were from countries. I don't know, a dozen countries. Across the globe, but I looked at really who got past the planning stages and who was actually testing hardware and testing and flying and failing and testing again and building stuff and flying things. So that was what and then I wanted to look at, some of these individuals who really were kind of these average Joes, these average people, but had this shared dream and did really remarkable things, got very far along in this race to win the XPRIZE. And against all odds, you had this engineering student in Romania who drops out of school to his parents' dismay and starts building rockets in his father-in-law's backyard, in outside of Bucharest. And it becomes the town, folks would, bring their little folding chairs and watch this. There's nothing else going on. And the government was very against what Dumitru Popescu was doing because they were supposed to be doing this and they had all the funding and they weren't. And his story is really heroic and very risk, huge risks that he took. And he ends up flying, not winning the prize, but flying the largest privately built rocket ever flown from Romania at that time. And today he has an aerospace company in New Mexico, ARCA Aerospace, ARCA, which is pretty cool. And a similar story in England with a guy named Steve Bennett, who was working in a Colgate toothpaste factory. And he was another one of these who just hears about this and was one of these dreamers of getting to space. And he eventually leaves this steady factory job and maxes out his credit cards. His wife nearly divorces him. He's practically living in his car, all to fund this this rocket company to win the XPRIZE. And he, in the great scenes with him in the book, where he, again risking everything and all of his money on the line and in debt, and nobody thought he could do this, and flies the largest private rocket ever flown from the UK mainland. And today he has. Still working in rocketry and has a STEM education kind of rocket company that he does. So, and then you have a fellow in Texas named John Carmack, whose great story He was famous at the time for video game programmer coder. He had done Quake and Doom and all sorts of things. Today, he's the CTO of Oculus Rift. But he heard about the XPRIZE, and he wanted to see if he could apply his coding programming for video games, computers, to rocketry. And they ended up building and flying a ton of stuff. And he's determined to one day get back into rocketry as well. But interesting stories like that across the globe, where people put a lot on the line. And then, you know, and then you had Bert Rattan, who's quite a character when you meet him. And I think he's this larger than life figure. I think he kind of jumps off the page.
And you did more than, I read that you did more than 100 interviews for this book. Bert was one of them. And I mean, he jumps off the page for sure. But in real life, when you meet him, he's that way as well.
He is. He's a little intimidating when you first meet him. He's very tall, and he has these big blue eyes, which just kind of bore into you like, you know, you got to know your stuff, or just admit that you don't and ask in earnest, which was more my approach. Because, you know, I mean, he's been living, breathing airplanes since he was a little boy, and that's his genius and his obsession. But what a wonderful human being. And today he has, you know, six or so of his own designs in the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum. And, you know, I mean, there's a maverick, there's a legend, there's a think different type. And I loved spending time with him. And his story of going after the XPRIZE with Spaceship One, and his famous backer who came into play, Paul Allen, the co-founder of Microsoft, is a great story. But it's really this small team in the Mojave Desert doing what many considered impossible, and the friendships and the bravery and the innovations and even a few love stories here and there.
There is so much, Julian, here to get to. We won't get to just a fraction of it this hour. What a great read. This narrative of the book, How to Make a Spaceship, all the figures in here that won that $10 million XPRIZE in 2004. Bert Rattan, we remember, Julian, Iowa Public Radio listeners will remember his news that was made with the Voyager aircraft that he designed, the first one to fly around the world without stopping or refueling.
Yeah, and his brother, Dick Rattan. I love those two and their story. But, you know, flying that with his co-pilot, Gina Yeager. And there's a couple great scenes in the book where I spent a lot of time also interviewing Dick Rattan. But what an incredible story those two are, and what they've accomplished. And, you know, the history that was made, and whether or not you're a space person or an aviation person. I mean, it's really about these big dreams and how to realize them. And in this case, you know, it was just drama and risking your life in these moments when tens of thousands of people were there watching live.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about everything on the line, right?
Right, exactly. We have a little bit of the audio from the live stream of the first flight of Spaceship One for this prize. Before we get to that, though, how was funding is a part of the book here, and as you say, because of the Lindbergh connection, funding was a key here. That proved to be quite a challenge. Tell us about Peter Diamandis's efforts to raise the $10 million. He approached a lot of big names that we know now: Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, Richard Branson. Right? They all said no.
Yes, and I love it, of course, that eventually, you know, Peter found his backer in a woman who was an entrepreneur and a risk taker, and she comes in and helps fund this. But funding was a huge part, and any entrepreneurs or any individual out there with a small business who is struggling, here's a great story for you, because Peter went to over 150 people, you know, who told him no, 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 and everybody wanted to know, why isn't NASA doing this, and what if someone dies? You know, they didn't want their brand. I mean, not to take it lightly, but they didn't want their brand associated with this. Was risky stuff. And So even Peter's closest friends, at one point after September 11th, after 9/11, were telling him, this is not going to work. You know, you've got to give this up. And I mean, you know, he had announced the prize without the $10 million prize, without the $10 million. And then he's trying desperately to raise it. And he, just like Burt Rutan and these others, came up with these improbable designs for their spaceships. Peter was coming up with these very unlikely methodologies to get his prize funded. You know, I mean, kind of crazy stuff, but great for entrepreneurs, where he ends up, you know, getting basically an insurance company to bet against him to fund, kind of this hole-in-one insurance is called, where they would bet against him, anyone actually succeeding in this, because it was just seemed so obvious it was not going to happen. So the insurance company put up part of the money, and they were going to pay out, you know, if it happened, but it was so unlikely. So, and then he got this woman, Anousheh Ansari. He found her, this woman who also had dreamed from childhood, and she'd grown up in Tehran, and dreaming of getting to space. And so she funds, Anousheh Ansari funds part of it, and it becomes known as the Ansari X Prize. But they cobbled this together, and again, Eric Lindberg, you know, comes into play around 2002 again, and does something really extraordinary, and rescues the X Prize by going on his own epic flight, kind of recreating in a way the flight of his grandfather, Charles Lindbergh, in 1927. Mm-hmm. So he pieces together the funding finally, but then there's a deadline of the end of 2004. This has to happen or the funding basically will go away. The hole-in-one insurance is not going to continue past January 1st, 2005. So, or the end of, yes, the end of, very end of 1994. And, or 2004, sorry. So you have this race, you know, and then the momentum picks up. The momentum picks up. Can it be done? Can it be done?
And we're going to leave a we're going to leave it as a cliffhanger until we return in a few minutes, Julie and Guthrie. There are a lot of cliffhangers in your book, so I'm going to give you one right now. Hang on, Julian. We'll be back with this exciting space trip by Spaceship One, the winner of the Ansari X Prize in 2004. We have audio from that flight, and we hope you'll stay with us. My guest, Julian Guthrie, How to Make a Spaceship, her latest book, A Band of Renegades, An Epic Race, and The Birth of Private Spaceflight, the story of the contest, the $10 million Ansari X Prize to build a private reusable spaceship. That, when we return, I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, the story of the worldwide contest for the $10 million Ansari X Prize, a prize to build a private reusable spacecraft. The winner took that prize in 2004. Spaceship One, the title of the craft that did it. Julian Guthrie, the author of the book How to Make a Spaceship, A Band of Renegades, An Epic Race, and The Birth of Private Spaceflight. And she does a wonderful job of telling us the background of the really unique people who made this happen. Mainly Peter Diamandis, a Greek-American engineer, a physician, founder and chairman of the XPRIZE Foundation, but also Burt Rutan, the inventor of Spaceship One, his brother Dick, also the two test pilots. These are the Chuck Yeagers of this story, Mike Melville and Brian Binney. And Julian joins us for this hour. If you'd like to join with a question, 1-866-780-9100. we want to get to the climax of this story. We have a bit of audio from that first flight that was part of the prize-winning flight. But tell us about Spaceship One. We have Paul Allen, co-founder of Microsoft, saying no, then changing his mind, agreeing to fund the development of Rutan's Spaceship One. Tell us about this spaceship. We get a mental image of how it was different, because there was a major design difference here, the feather, right? And how it was launched.
Right. It's really just a beautiful story of how they came up with that, how Burt Rutan came up with that. So being an airplane designer, and as you had said, he was the designer of the Voyager, the first plane to fly nonstop, non-refueled around the world with his brother, Dick Rutan, as a pilot, he was used to creating these improbable flying machines. And so he thinks about how to get to space from, an airplane designer standpoint. So he also had been very close to Edwards Air Force Base and then worked there out of college as well. And so he was very familiar with the X-15 program, the military space plane, and which used a mothership to bring the space plane actually up to altitude. And so that was the model that he used. And for the XPRIZE, he had to design and build this mothership that was called the White Knight, which is really beautiful. Anybody can Google images of it. It's really gorgeous. It was a carrier plane, and it would carry, this little spaceship, which would fit in a large garage, up to altitude, up to around 50,000 feet. So as Burt saw it, the first 50,000 feet are free, basically. So he got up to altitude, up to 50,000 feet. Then they drop launch from the mothership, from the White Knight, the spaceship. And the pilot inside, lights the motor. And as described to me, it's like riding a bull out of the chute. It was just immediate and terrifying and adrenalizing and holy cow, hang on, for your life sort of ride. And so then the little spaceship that could has to make it up, through the transonic region, past Mach 1, past through the speed of sound, and to the other side, and 62 miles up. And there's a period there after riding this raging bull where, as the pilots described it to me, there are 3 to 4 minutes of relative, of course, that's the word, tranquility, where you're in microgravity or zero gravity, and you can look back at planet, at the Earth below, and you can see the beauty of it. And in those moments, there were a couple of moments or minutes even where the pilots could exhale and they could take in this spectacle that very few people have actually seen. And so they have that, but then there is still the reentry, which has always been the most vexing part of human spaceflight. How do you get people back in through the Earth's atmosphere safely to the ground? And there have been tragedies throughout, manned spaceflight, whether military or NASA.
Yes, the Challenger.
Coming back to Earth.
Challenger disasters, yeah.
Exactly. Instance. And so Burt's genius here, is the feather. And that is basically once the pilot had was going into this period of microgravity or zero gravity, they would activate the feather. And basically what that meant is, if people can visualize, it was just the kind of crazy, the back end of the plane kind of folding up like your arm does at the elbow. And it was like it would induce this natural drag, so the back wings would fold up and it would reorient, almost like a badminton birdie shuttlecock, reorient the plane, the spaceship, perfectly at the right angle, just like a badminton birdie comes down at a certain angle naturally. So Burt's idea was, you do this, the wing is up for drag, slows it down. It's reoriented the nose of the spaceship to come back through the transonic region And, you know, other aerodynamicists told Bert not only would it not work, but that it would result in a fatal spin, and his pilots, who happened to be, his best friends, would die. They would not make it. And Bert stuck to his belief, his gut instinct, his experience, and, of course, all of the tests that they did. But that was the breakthrough there. It also required these test pilots, who are heroes in my mind, who are just extraordinary, seemingly ordinary people. And I love their stories. And so Bert needed them. They needed Bert. And so it was this, team effort. And it was the people who, dropped everything to come to the Mojave and work for Bert Rattan and signed on to be a part of this team that built it, that built the spaceship from scratch, that largely built the motor, that, figured out this feather thing. There are fun stories even about the paint for heat resistance and thermal protection. Mm-hmm. So it was a team, but each person, but really the breakthrough was, as you referenced, it was this feather design, which now is being used by Richard Branson and his Virgin Galactic spaceship too.
Julian Guthrie is with me. If you just joined us, her latest book, How to Make a Spaceship, it tells the story of the worldwide contest for the XPRIZE to build a private reusable spaceship. And Julian, our flight is coming to an end. We want to get in this bit of audio, and I think I found the audio that actually links up with sort of the really tense moment you actually open your book with. This is Mike Melville, one of the test pilots, there too, going up. I took this from the live stream here. Perhaps you can set it up. This is about a minute or a minute and a half after detaching from the mothership, a White Knight, Spaceship One, goes into sort of a barrel roll. Before we hear the audio, tell us a little bit about what's happening, and you'll hear the worry in the announcers' voices.
Yeah, so this is September 28, 2004, and this is the first XPRIZE flight. Tens of thousands of people have poured into the Mojave Desert in the dark of night and are there to witness what they hope will be history. Mike Melville's wife, the love of his life, whom he ran away from South Africa with when they were teenagers, is there on the Mojave floor. Mike is 64 years old when he is attempting to be the world's first commercial astronaut. Peter Diamandis is on the desert floor with his father, his mother, his family. Dreams potentially could come true, or everything could go wrong. And that's what you're about to hear.
Okay.
And it's an amazing story.
Right. And to get an idea of the speeds, we can talk about Mach 1 or Mach 2. This is faster than a bullet, right?
Yes. This is faster than a speeding bullet.
Mm-hmm. Literally. Here's some audio. As I said, about a minute or so after detaching from the mothership, when this fuse is lit and it's like a bull being let out of the gate, and then you'll hear in the announcer's voice something starts to go wrong.
Viewers are enjoying unprecedented camera coverage from the ground here. A radar-locked camera from Edwards Air Force Base tracking Spaceship One as it streaks through the sky to punch through the atmosphere and reach suborbital flight. 35 seconds, 135,000 feet into the flight.
Looking for an 87-second burn. Uh-oh.
He's in a roll, it appears, at this point. Does not appear to be a scripted maneuver.
Shut down. Come on, Mike.
We have shut down main engines to Spaceship One.
You hear in those voices similar tones to the Challenger quote, does not appear to be a scripted maneuver. Come on, Mike. You hear the tension. How did he what was going on here, Julian, and how did Mike recover here?
So actually Mike did 29 barrel rolls shooting straight up like, a bullet that shot straight up, and the world is spinning. 29 unscripted is, I guess, the greatest euphemism ever. But
right.
roles. And, you know, someone else could have lost it at that point. And he kept his eyes focused on the instrument panel and did not look around so as not to become so disoriented as ineffective. And he just thought he would ride it out. And he'd been in so many of these, you know, crazy designs that always came back safely. And but in that time, you know, it was, is he going to pull himself out? Is he going to pull the spaceship out of this? 29 rolls, you know, at mock speeds. And he's thinking about all of, you know, he's thinking about control, but all of these things, you know, his wife on the desert floor and what is all at stake, you know, that's what he's thinking about. And he's an unbelievable test pilot who kept it together, you know, the bravery and the skill in his years and years of experience. And he pulls it off and somehow, you know, glides back, you know, to that desert floor, to the cheering crowds of tens of thousands of people who are within, you know, 100 feet from the world's first private spaceship. And he was 64 years old when he did that. Mm-hmm. So how's that for bravery? You know, they still have the next XPRIZE flight, though.
Right, the second one. Let's get to that briefly. A different test pilot here, Brian Binney, and Unscripted, also we can talk about this one. Humorous here that he connects this flight with the smell of, what is it, vanilla coffee, right?
I know. Isn't that great? Brian's story is pretty amazing. So he had, on an earlier test flight, he had crash-landed the spaceship when Paul Allen, the benefactor, was watching. And so not his best moment. He was a career, you know, decorated Navy pilot who came to work in the Mojave. And anyway, we would not let that crash landing of the spaceship define him earlier. This was an earlier test flight. And he had been working determined, you know, sort of rocky struggle to get back into that spaceship and to get his shot at redemption. And so October 4th, 2004, all of the world is watching. This is the money flight. The $10 million is on the line. And Brian Binney is chosen to be the test pilot. Mike has flown so many flights, and Mike has been kind of the tutor to Brian to get him back into that cockpit. So then Brian Binney he's going to do it, and he's determined. And the coffee anecdote is so fun because when Brian was all suited up in his pilot gear and walking out, everybody was coming to hug him, including his mother-in-law, who he tells this very funny story. She was holding a cup of McDonald's coffee, large, caffeinated, and vanilla flavoring. And as soon as he hugged her, he felt the heat of the coffee going down the back of his flight suit. And he was on his way to the cockpit, so he couldn't change. One of the aerodynamicists, a brilliant guy named Jim Tai, told him it actually cost him like 500 feet of in his trajectory, the weight of that coffee. Anyway, so he gets into the spaceship, and it's just now just infused with the smell of French vanilla coffee is all around him in this cockpit on this historic, you know, redemption-seeking flight. So it was a great moment. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you want me to go on and tell how it ends up.
Very quickly. So. We've got about 5 or so minutes left. I wanted to ask you a couple other things, but finish up with the prize-winning part of this. Yeah.
Okay, so Brian is determined to nail it. This is everything he's been working for in the simulator. He's been, you know, jogging every night, you know, in the desert when it's 100 degrees. He's been training with Mike Melville in Mike's long, easy plane, which was similar in size to the spaceship. He's been doing everything to get back in. And so he's in the cockpit, and they take him to altitude, and he's drop launched. And his wife, who's a very religious Catholic woman, had a whole prayer group galvanized from across the world praying for her husband. And, you know, Brian, he was ready. He had visualized it, you know, like a trained athlete, and he nailed it. He not only, you know, got past that that magical, mythical von Karman line, but he exceeded the X-15 record that had been set in the 60s. So he surpassed that went, you know, way past that, got so much power out of that motor, and then came back. And of course, this was his potential nemesis. And can he make the landing? Can he, you know, he everything had appeared smooth on the flight, the test flight he had done until, you know, everything went wrong. So everyone is waiting, holding their breath. Burt Rutan in control center, and Paul Allen standing behind him, Mike Melville watching, you know, hands clasped, everyone, Peter Diamandis, of course, everything on the line. And Brian just takes it one step at a time and visualizes and comes down smooth as butter, landing on that runway in the Mojave to the cheering, you know, crowds, and history made, accomplished, and redemption found for that certain pilot. So,
Julian,
really beautiful moment.
Yes, it is. It raises the hair on the back of your neck when you read it and you imagine a little bit of what it must have been like in the Mojave Desert and all that went into the culmination there, winning the X Prize in 2004. What was the significance of the X Prize in Spaceship One? In what way does it represent a turning point?
I think it was, first it was the world's first private spaceship. And so it proved it could be done by a small team doing big things. What only the world's largest governments, the U.S., the former Soviet Union, and China had done before. So it was this. It was a validation of entrepreneurs and, you know, individualists everywhere. It was a validation of the crowdsourcing sort of methodology using incentive prizes. And it was, you know, stirring the dream again of private spaceflight and everyday citizens one day getting there. And I think for, you know, for Elon Musk, whom I've interviewed for the book, you know, it was very inspiring. And Elon saw how, you know, so many people across the globe were behind this and still wanted, you know, to see the dream that had been started with Apollo to be continued into the modern day. So I think it was very inspiring in that way. And same with Jeff Bezos, and clearly with Richard Branson, who had bought the intellectual property to Spaceship One to create his own space company, Virgin Galactic. And he, by the way, is going to sign, Richard Branson is signing a number of copies of my book, which we're giving away on Facebook to people who share their moonshots. So if you go to Facebook and search How to Make a Spaceship Book, you'll see all of that. It's a pretty neat thing. To give away books signed by Richard Branson and Peter Diamandis. But what you see happening today, I think was largely inspired in many instances by the story of Peter Diamandis and Spaceship One and that remarkable team in the Mojave Desert.
Mm-hmm. We've got a minute or two left. How far are we away from space tourism? This takes us up to 2004. Of course, we're far ahead of that now. How far are we away from this being a regular thing? It's a matter of just having the money to do it.
I think it's been very disappointing to Peter and others that it's taken so long, but I think that it's finally happening. You know, you see Elon Musk and SpaceX, and his partnership with NASA, with the government, is really promising. And you see Jeff Bezos with Blue Origin and doing really impressive things with suborbital flight and pushing toward orbital, and Virgin Galactic and other companies, private industry, doing what only the government had done before. So we're at a great point. And, you know, big dreamers with very big bank accounts who are, you know, set on this path. So I think we're at the most promising time in a long, long time.
Big dreamers with big bank accounts, that's kind of what you like to cover and write about when we look at Larry Ellison and his quest for America's Cup, your previous book. What's in store for you next? Will you do the next chapter of this privatized space race?
Well, I really like underdog stories, and Billionaire and the Mechanic was, even though you don't think of Larry Ellison as an underdog, his story, you know, going back to the South Side of Chicago and growing up there is a great underdog story. The next one I'm doing, it's called Alpha Girls, and it's about this group of pioneering women in Silicon Valley and their stories that have never been told, how they built up some of the biggest companies of our day. So I'm just starting to work on that. And similar themes, you know, it's underdog stories that I seem to gravitate to.
Okay. Julian Guthrie, we've run out of time. So great. So wonderful to have you share with us the subject of your latest book, How to Make a Spaceship, A Band of Renegades, An Epic Race, The Birth of Private Spaceflight. So many stories, tense moments, human stories that we didn't get to this hour. Julian Guthrie, thank you for spending the hour with us to talk about how to make a spaceship and the XPRIZE.
Well, I'm grateful for your kind words and your interest and your time. Thank you.
River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Help today from Robbie Broad. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.